Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. And my interview today is with Natalie McLean, who's a famous wine writer, has written several books. Her newsletter, her website, it's one of the biggest, most influential in Canada. She's won basically every award that you can win as a wine journalist. She has won it. One of the most powerful people in terms of influence in the industry here in Canada. You see her on CTV, on the social, all the time. I didn't have a chance to say to her that I'm jealous she's on that show. I've been weaseling to get my way onto the social. It has not worked as of yet, even though I do work for CTV. And this interview is a little bit different because it's the first one I've done via Skype. And the quality, it's not as good as if she was, if we were in the same place together, and you know, so the quality isn't as good, but it's more than good enough. I was surprised. People might not know this. I'm not very good when it comes to technology, and I get insecure. I get nervous about it. So of course, the first time I'm going to attempt to do a wine interview, it's with Natalie McLean. And the only difference you'll really notice is there's not as much, it's hard to be as conversational because we did it just audio. It wasn't a video one. And it's hard because there's a slight delay. So it is a little bit hard to have like a back and forth conversation where I would say 14 words, she'd say 11, and you know, back and forth. Like it's more paragraph, paragraph versus sentence from me, sentence from her, if that makes sense. But I'm excited. I thought it turned out well. And the great thing is once I get more comfortable doing this, I'm hoping to be able to do interviews with winemakers all around the world. I was talking with some of the representatives for Francis Ford Coppola and hoping to interview their winemaker and then hopefully one day Francis, fingers crossed, or you know, a famous restaurateur in Mexico, I believe Mexico City, who is very important to the wine scene there. So this could open up to just a lot more guests, a lot more diversity. So hopefully that's something that you will hear on this podcast in the future. Now, before we get to the interview, a couple things. I want to give wine recommendation and I want to talk about Disney because yes, a guy in his 40s without kids, naturally I go to Disney. I'll get into that in a second. But I'll start there. If you have a chance, go to the Epcot International Food and Wine Show. It is great. It's really well done. It's well spread out. There's so many different countries, and the food is as authentic as you could imagine. I mean, you know, it's not like you're in a little, you know, a local diner in Thailand, but they put a lot of time and effort there in Disney to make it as realistic as possible. On the wine end, there's a bunch of good stuff. Like I appreciated that in Australia, they had 100% Sémillon. You know, I expected, okay, you know, just to appease the masses, we'll have just Chardonnay or Pinot Grigio, and maybe if we're really daring, we'll get like a Clare Valley Riesling, which, by the way, that would have been good. But they had a Sémillon, and you know, I appreciated that. There was a Switzerland station, and they had, you know, a wine from one of the more southern Swiss appellations, whose name I can't pronounce. But you know, a Pinot Noir Gamay blend from Switzerland was cool. You know, they made sure to have Gewürztraminer at Thailand to pair with the spicy food. I would have wanted more from Canada. But that's just prejudice. You know, they had two wines, both from Chateau Deschamps, an ice wine, naturally, and a Merlot. I would have liked to have seen, obviously, I'm biased, a Pinot or a Chardonnay from Prince Edward County, a Bordeaux blend. You know, they had the Merlot from Niagara, so that was good. But, you know, something from BC. I would love to have seen more sparkling from Nova Scotia, but, you know, that's not going to happen. Anyway, I was being a little greedy there. Italy and France, they were good. I thought the big winner was Germany. They had tons of different Rieslings to try. They had, you know, Auslesis. They had a dessert wine. They even had a Pinot. They didn't need to do that. They didn't need to put a Pinot from Germany, but they did. So good on them. So if you are in Disney, if you've got kids, if the kids can go off on their own, let them do that. They're not going to be that excited, you know. When you're 11, you're not really into let's try wine and food from around the world. You know, that's something more for the parents. It's a good thing that I'm a professional uncle, so I did not have to worry about that whatsoever. But definitely go and check it out if you are in the Disney area, if there's a way you can get away from your kids. And if you don't have kids and you're thinking of going to Disney, it's brilliant as well. So every now and then, if you're really big into wine and it's, you know, becomes more a part of your life, people will just, you know, start calling you, oh, wine snob. Oh, look at all the fancy wine you drink. Which, by the way, if that's the biggest criticism someone gives you, it's pretty damn good. I'd like to be known as, oh, there goes Kaz. More second growth from him. How awesome would that be? But got to try. I was visiting my dad for lunch. And under $13, just a very simple Beaujolais Supérieur from Bouchard Ain Enfis. I knew I was going to mispronounce that. Under $13. And it was delicious. You know, it had everything you want. You know, just juicy red fruit, a little bit of black fruit, a little bit of spice. It was nice. There's not a lot of depth to it. There's not a lot of length, but that's not the point. You'll often hear that term, a cafe wine, which basically means something light, enjoyable, not too expensive. And this would absolutely fill it, but it does what Beaujolais is supposed to do. You know, I'm not looking for some, you know, wine where I've got to sit and brood over it and really think it through. That was not this wine whatsoever, but it was great. And, you know, it went well with our lunch, chicken and potatoes, and, you know, it would go well with a bunch of different foods. So if you're looking for a good wine, especially, you know, an afternoon, a lunch sort of wine or something, you know, early in the evening with, you know, if you're doing any sort of charcuterie or cheeses or whatever, go grab a bottle. $12.95, varietally correct, from Beaujolais. You know, from a very, you know, well-known negociant, the Bouchard there. So that is my wine recommendation, as my vacation recommendation. Hope everyone is doing well. Thank you so much for listening to the pod. Remember to tell your friends, your family, your enemies, whomever, to rate, review, subscribe, and all that good stuff. As we're now on iHeartRadio and Stitcher and Spotify and iTunes or whatever, iTunes, Apple Podcast. I don't know what it is, but I know it still goes there. So without further ado, because I mentioned in the podcast, but if you want to check out Natalie McLean's food and wine pairing guide, and you can get it for free, just go to nataliemclean.com/Matt. That's nataliemclean.com/MATT. So without further ado, here's Natalie McLean.
The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. And this is my first Skype interview. This is my first one where the person isn't in studio. You'd think I'd pick a lesser celebrity because in case it goes wrong. Nope, the other way. One of the biggest, most important writers when it comes to wine, Natalie McLean from nataliemclean.com is joining me. Natalie, thanks so much for joining the podcast.
Oh, Matt, it's my pleasure. And thank you for that kind intro. I'm really happy to be here with you. I've been enjoying listening to your episodes.
Well, thanks. I mean, that means a lot. It really does. I appreciate. I've enjoyed reading your books. I was mentioned before we got started. I have a copy of your first book, Red, White, and Drunk All Over, which I read when it came out. I've seen, obviously, The Social. I'm friends with a bunch of those people. And for people listening, Natalie McLean, I could read all her awards, but she's won all of them. If there's a James Beard Award, she has won it. All the Best Green Awards, every culinary award you can win, she's won it multiple times and a fantastic author. I want to get a lot into your wine course. And you actually offered up a link in Wine Pairing Guide, which I want to get into, which thank you. But I first want to go back because I love the wine moment involving your future husband and a bottle of Brunello.
Ah, right. Okay. Well, I guess, you know, everybody has that first wine that sort of turns them on to wine. And mine was after we had finished graduate school down in Western, we moved to Toronto, where all the young couples without kids do. And we had an apartment near Yonge and Eglinton, and we went to a restaurant, small Italian bistro that we loved. And I remember one of the first times we were there, the server said, well, would you like to try the Brunello? And we thought, wow, that must be a interesting or new pasta dish. I don't know. So we said, yeah, sure, we'll try the Brunello. And so he brought over a couple of tumbler glasses and the bottle, and he just sort of sloshed it in. There was none of that ceremony of looking at the label and sniffing and corks and everything. It was just like, and he just banged the glasses down on the table and left. So he thought, well, it's not pasta. Let's give it a try. So I remember raising that glass up to drink it, because I was just going to do what I usually did and just drink it. But the aromas hit me before the glass did, and I just remember, oh my goodness, what is this? And so I slowed down, and I wanted to put into words what I was smelling, and I couldn't, because I didn't have any wine background. Scottish family, beer and whiskey in Nova Scotia, so there was no training here. And I drank it, and it got even better. You know, as it sort of, I swished it around, or not swished, I wasn't doing anything technical. I was just tasting it and thinking, oh my goodness, what is this? I need to figure out what this is so I can have it again and again and again and again. So that really was the wine that sort of started it for me, and also the need to put into words what I was smelling and tasting. I didn't want to just make sure I could buy that bottle again. I wanted to make sure I knew what it was and why I loved it.
Yeah. It's funny for you. Like, we have very similar stories in the sense that for you it was Brunello, for me it was Barolo. And when I started to get into wine, I thought Merlot meant a region in Italy. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I had no idea. And it's interesting just your journey from there till now. You sort of mentioned it. I mean, this is sort of unique for you because your background was beer, wine, and beer, whiskey, and box wine back in Nova Scotia, correct?
Yes, it was a terrible, terrible childhood. well, yeah, all of my relatives are Scottish. They're either McDonald's or McLean's. And so beer and whiskey was on the table as I was growing up. I really didn't partake as a child. But I just didn't get into wine. Wine wasn't part of the culture. So my first wine experience was in back of the portable at the high school dance with baby ducks sparkling. And
oh, yeah.
That was just, had a miserable vice grip of a headache the next day, and didn't try wine again until we'd finished school. So I was in my mid-20s before I even had wine again, you know, other than the one undrinkable glass of wine at Easter, which was the same one they had served at Christmas from the same box. But other than that, you know, wine just wasn't part of my world until fairly late in life.
Yeah. And then let's jump ahead for a second, because, you know, then when I'm reading your first book, the first chapter, you're at the holy land of Pinot Noir. I'm curious, what was it like to be interviewing and being around maybe the most famous winemaker in the world?
Yeah, that was an unbelievable journey. I'll just back up a little bit. I wanted to go to Burgundy because I found it so darn confusing. I mean, as you know, Matt, I mean, it's the patches of vineyards owned by different people. It's so confusing. So in Bordeaux, as you know, we had the system of primogeniture. So the firstborn son got all the land, and therefore we have these large, relatively easy to understand estates, wine estates in Bordeaux, not happening in Burgundy under the Napoleonic Code. So all the heirs divided all the lands. And so you have something like a vineyard, Clos de Bougeot, having 82 owners, and some of them only a few vines. And it's beautiful wine, but it's as confusing as heck. And then you have all the regions and subregions and all this, like, it's almost like Russian nesting dolls. Trying to figure all that out is just, it can warp your mind. So I wanted to go there because I think there's nothing like traveling to the place to understand the wines. And I know that can be a bit of a cliche, but it actually imprints for me when I have to drive myself like and get lost and go down wrong roads and actually be attentive to where I am all the time, trying to get to the next place. And then, you know, tasting the wines in the place that they were made, that really, really anchors it for me in memory and sorts out all the confusion. So that's why I was there. But on to your question, I was fortunate enough to be able to spend a good amount of time with Aubert de Villaine, who is the winemaker of Domaine Romanée-Conti, as you alluded to, probably one of the most coveted wines in the world, Burgundian. And he was gracious. He took me out to the vines, and I offered to snip some because it was pruning time. He said, don't go near them. but then he took me down in the library. And this was a smaller cellar off the main cellar where he kept older vintages. And so I was about to walk in. I could see all the cobwebs. And he goes, turn around. So I did. And I could hear him hauling a bottle off the shelf, and I thought, oh no, what's this? And not that, you know, oh no, I get to taste Domaine Romanée-Conti, but what is he up to? So he uncorked it, and we started tasting, and he made me guess what the vintage was.
Really?
And, yeah, he did. So I started trying to narrow it down, right, trying to look not like a fool, because you know how guessing games go oh so well. And so I thought, well, okay, his cellar, I at least had seen that it sort of started in the late 1800s and was up to, it was the wine library. So it looked like it went to maybe the 1980s. So I just thought, well, okay, I'm going to try somewhere in the middle. I was just literally slicing the pie.
Yeah.
Excuse me for a moment. Alexa, stop. Sorry, I had an Alexa reminder to call you.
That's hilarious.
Oh no, I turned off all my cell phones and all that, but you know,
there technology, we are. There's always something going.
Modern technology, yes. Okay, so anyway, back yeah. to the story. Yeah, so
that's in the vintage.
Yeah, I'm trying to split it in the middle, and I'm thinking, oh, what am I going to do here? I'm going to say, so I just took a dart. Throwing a dart at the dartboard is basically what it was. And I said, how about the 1950s? And he said, yes. Okay, keep going. And I thought about faking it with rains in 54 or something like this, which I totally did not know. I thought, I'm not doing that with this guy. So I just kept tasting it, and it was so alive. I'm thinking, this is a 1950 DRC, and it tastes amazing. So I'm hemming and hawing, and then I thought, okay, you know what? I'm going to split it again in the 1950s, but I won't go right in the middle. I'll just go one up. Literally, it was guessing. 1956. Yeah. And no one's going to believe me because I didn't record it, but it was right.
Ah, that must have felt great.
It was, but it was totally fluky. Like, yeah. I had no idea. But then his eyes really lit up, and I think he would have almost let me prune those vines after that, but he didn't.
Well, I mean, the thing is what you did there, I mean, how many times have you done a blind tasting and you're sort of debating between, you know, you've got some sort of like slightly aromatic white and then you've got to just guess fruity or something. And, you know, sometimes, you know, you just take that chance. I mean, good for you for getting it right, even if it wasn't the most scientific.
Exactly. Well, I had some parameters, but it was fun to play the guessing game. And it was a whole lot better that it turned out all right.
And how'd that bottle taste?
Oh my goodness. It was like drinking silk woven by angels a long time ago. And that, you know, it just seemed to seep into all of my senses. It went into every little crevice and in my mouth. And then it just seemed to just go out through my dendrites and capillaries right to the edges of all my senses. It was amazing. So anyway,
That's a great descriptor. So we're going to bounce around. I mean, we're not going to have time for everything, but your first book, Red, White, and Drunk All Over,
Is a ton of fun and self-deprecating and knowledgeable and just a very different approach to writing a wine book. It's great. And then your second one, Unquenchable, a tipsy quest for the world's best bargain wines. And I want to get into that theme in a second. But is there a third book coming out? I was doing my research. What's next for you in terms of writing?
Well, I'm working on my third book now, and it's more of a memoir. It's set in the wine world. It's nonfiction, mm-hmm. but it's a story of working and in the wine world and how social media impacts that, and a couple of very current issues. So I know that's a bit of a tease, but it's going to be quite different from the first two books, which are really, I travel to a wine region, I interview a wacky winemaker who, yeah. you know, has been unleashed from his PR people. And, you know, we learn something. We might do something crazy, like go diving with sharks or milk a goat, and then we wrap it all up. This one is more from my 20 years of writing about wine as a woman in the industry, with the impacts of social media for good and for not so good. I want to tell a far more personal story this time. I'm pretty excited about it.
Oh, that's fantastic. How different of a writer are you now versus your first book?
You know, your first book, you have the gift of naivete, and all your impressions are the first ones in many cases, the first time you maybe visit a winery or help with the harvest, the first time you go undercover as a sommelier to get those kinds of insights. So that's the gift of the first book. And the first book, everyone gives you the benefit of the doubt. Few people want to be mean to you. Yeah. So that's good. That goes well. And then your second one, you have to up your game. You have to get better at your craft. You have to dig deeper, all of which I tried to do. And I think succeeded in terms of what the reviews said. But today, you know, what I'm trying to do is keep my fresh perspective, the energy and the enthusiasm of an amateur, and not to forget that, because that's where most of my readers are. But to inform that now with my experience of having been writing about wine for 20 years, to bring more craft to it, to be there for the reader. So I'm asking the questions the reader would love to ask, but that person is not going to get in to see Domaine Romani Conti. And the only reason, by the way, Matt, that I would get in to see Domaine Romani Conti is that Aubert de Villaine and his like recognize how many readers I bring with me. It's not me. It's the readership that I bring with me. And so I'm trying to ask the questions they'd be dying to ask. And even if they were there, maybe they'd be too embarrassed to ask. So I'm a very, very nosy person, but I'm also very shy. And so writing has given me the cover of being able to ask people things like, well, what is your greatest failure? What'd you learn from it? Those kinds of things that can be uncomfortable if you just sort of turned to someone at a dinner party and started down that road.
And you know what? How difficult is it for you, not just with your books, but also your newsletter, which is incredible. It's won a whole bunch of awards as well. Again, Natalie, you win lots of awards, rightfully so. And again, people can go to nataliemclain.com. How difficult is it for you about trying, and it's something I always struggle with this part, entering into the wine world, but also there's a lot of people that read your work that are into wine for years and study it and know a lot about it, about trying to find a balance to satiate both sides.
Yeah, it's the thin red line we walk, Matt.
Yeah.
So I think that where people converge, no matter what their level of wine knowledge is that we are all lovers of stories. So your master sommeliers and master of wines, I think they'd like to know what it's like to have to spend a day with Aubert de Villaine. What does he say? What is he like? What do you do? You know, and then the person who knows nothing or very little about Burgundy gets to learn about Burgundy through a story, not a textbook. And that's why all of my books are story-based. We're wired for stories. We remember stories. It's, you know, what we laugh at, or what, you know, drives other emotions, that emotion is the anchoring point for remembering information, just like alcohol is the carrier of flavor in wine. You've got to have those stories that deliver the emotions and the stories if, you know, someone's going to remember to get the education about wine.
It's a great answer. And it's also most psalms that are working on the floor will always say the easiest way to sell wine is to tell the story, not what the acidity level is. So you break lots of rules all the time when it comes to a lot of your wine notes, and you don't always go with the really sort of stuffy, archaic wine notes. But I'm wondering for writing in terms of like grammar rules you break, or, you know, what's the hardest thing in terms of, because I find with writing, I prefer, how do you deal with those things?
Well, I believe that ending a sentence with a preposition is nothing to be afraid of.
Yeah.
That's one. Also, sentence fragments. That's two. So what I mean by sentence fragments is that I think we need to write the way we talk. And in the wine world, my concern for myself personally is not so much about, you know, salad fruit descriptions and that sort of thing. It's getting away from the way we talk. I think we still need to write the way we talk conversationally. And that does mean sentence fragments. I'm not down to emojis just yet, but I'm really down with sentence fragments and trying to capture that dialogue. You know, you go back to Hemingway's very simple, very bare bones. But when you read it, you could hear the people talking and it sounded like real people. And that's the way I think we need to communicate in the wine world, especially if we're going to get rid of the still hanging around stigma or the way people can feel uptight about it. I think if they hear someone talking the way they talk in real conversation, that's a real barrier breaker.
Yeah, and it's something I think it is important, because you can intimidate or scare people when you go, it's a slightly bruised, you know, plum with porcini dust and, you know, on the mid-core sort of an orange pith. Like it can certainly be a barrier of entry for people just getting into wine. In 2012, you wrote, "I pride myself in being a wine cheapskate, as I don't think you should pay more for pleasure than you have to." And I sort of want to go to, you know, tips you would have for people in terms of finding bargain wine, in terms of, you know, countries to go to. I mean, the most obvious one is, you know, if you're looking for inexpensive wine, Burgundy and Bordeaux might not be the best place. But you've been to five continents, tons of countries. What are some tips you would give people when they want to look for good wine?
I always say go south. That's my first tip. So if you look at often the brand names or cachet regions are up north. If you think about Piedmont in Italy, or even Tuscany, go south to Sicily, and you'll find some marvelous wines. The climate is better there. It's warmer, so you're going to get more ripening and less dealing with vintage variation. The island of Sicily is wonderful for the Nero d'Avola, especially as you are probably familiar with that.
Yep.
That wine. Yep. So, and then in Bordeaux or Burgundy, I would go south to the Languedoc, even to Provence for rosés, but especially the Languedoc has, again, these great full-bodied reds and whites for a fraction of the cost. In California, instead of Napa Sonoma, go down to Paso Robles, and I think you'll get better deals. That's one tip, go south. Secondly, I would say look for wine regions that have had to deal with a poor reputation in the past and are trying to redeem themselves, if you will. So, you know, Austria had the antifreeze, watering down wines with antifreeze way back in the 80s. But it's still a region that is gloriously underpriced, Gruner Veltliner, a crisp, zesty white, and among others. Fantastic wines. If you look at Germany, perhaps still dealing with, you know, the sweet syrupy stuff of the 70s and 80s, beautiful, gorgeously crafted Rieslings, and I would say Pinot Noirs as well. If you look at South Africa, that was out of the game for apartheid, now offering amazing Pinotage, Sauvignon Blanc, you know, Chenin Blanc. So I would look for the redemption stories. That would be tip number two. And then tip number three is drink from your own backyard. Although Canadian wines are not inexpensive, they are a bargain compared to wines of other regions of the same quality. So if you drink our top tier or even mid-tier, say Pinot Noirs, and compare that to Burgundy, it's a steal.
Yeah. I like that. The redemption goes south. Drink from your own backyard, and you can drink, say, Clos and Chase Pinot Noir from Prince Edward County, and you know you can get one that will remind you of Burgundy. But yes. you'll save a lot of money. This sort of all goes into another question I want to get into about is you sent me a food and wine pairing guide for my listeners, and they can get it for free by going to nataliemclain.com/Matt. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit just about what people can find here, about your wine courses, and just, you know, why your website, you know, it can be an important resource for people who want to learn more about wine but don't want to be scared off.
Sure. Well, I do try to talk conversationally, as though just like you and I are right now, Matt.
Yeah.
We're almost sitting across the virtual kitchen table here over a glass of wine, and I think that's an approach that most people feel that's really comfortable. The storytelling is a big part of my wine courses. So as you mentioned, I teach online wine video courses. It's all video based because I feel that extra aspect of interaction really helps. And of course, it's a very sensory wine is a very sensory topic. So we're looking at the color and the taste and all the rest of it together, but it's a lot of food pairing that we do in the courses. So, there is more information on that on my website. Also, I have a free 1-hour class on my site at nataliemclain.com/class. And that will take you through the steps of pairing wine. Actually, it's the 5 mistakes you may be making that can ruin your dinner. That's the topic of that. And we, of course, fix the mistakes, and it's a happy ever after ending. But then I also have my longer paid courses that people take, and we have regular weekly tastings, and it's a lot of fun. People connect from all over the world. It's amazing because I've got lots of students from Canada, but also U.S., Australia, New Zealand, the UK, but even like Brazil, we get all sorts. And people are logging in from hotel rooms because they travel a lot for business or pleasure, or, you know, I get husband wives doing it as date night. It's a lot of fun.
And also, sorry to interrupt, the state of these courses is once you gain even a little more knowledge, you know, you feel more confident, and it just makes it a better experience when you go to a restaurant, we're looking at the wine list, or you're at your wine store trying to figure out what to buy.
Exactly. It's like when I was a dancer for 20 years. And so when I watch a ballet or any other dance performance, I have a muscular response. I'm taking it in with my eyes, but I'm reacting with my whole body because I have an appreciation for what it took to just do that pirouette. And I think similarly, wine is fine. If you don't want to go any further with it other than just drink and enjoy, that's fine. But I think for many of us, and I'm sure for your listeners and for you and I, we want to go deeper because we want to deepen our pleasure through appreciation, through our knowledge to say, wow, I love how this wine is in balance, and know what balance means. And still, you know, you can still be drinking and enjoying, but you have those extra elements of knowing why this wine is special. And most importantly, why you like it. You become the expert on your own palate.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. 100%. And yes, your own palate is important. You can, you know, don't worry about if you don't like all the second or third growth Bordeaux's. Even, you know, you're more of a big Napa cab drinker. That's fine. But yeah, it's good to know your own, like, to thine own self be true. Same thing. Know your own palate. So again, nataliemclain.com/Matt. Go check that out for a food and wine pairing guide from Natalie. I know we only have a couple more minutes. Again, could go on forever. I'm curious, just some random things. One of my favorite winemakers is Randall Graham from Bonnie Doon. This is delicious Rhone varietal, Rhone varietals. I love his work whenever I can get it here in Ontario. I believe you worked with him, or you were in his vineyard. I was wondering about any of those stories there.
Oh, he's a hoot. I mean, he's just so fun. He, as you know, Matt, he hosted a funeral in Grand Central Station in New York City for Cork. It was an open casket burial.
Oh, that's right.
Full of corks. And, you know, he's the Rone Ranger. He has an asteroid named after him. But yes, I helped him with the harvest, and he made me carry the spit bucket around the winery because he thought that would be fun to make a wine writer carry the spit bucket. And then he got me hauling hoses. He had a lot of fun with me there, and we were out picking grapes and all the rest of it. But he is brilliant. I mean, he is a storyteller, and, you know, he has a collected book of essays as well, a philosopher and a poet, too. So, again, I was after a man who, or a woman, who could tell a story, not just tell me what wine they were making and why, but kind of where that was rooted, what was driving him, what were the influences, and you know, we spent a couple of days together, actually, and really got down to some very interesting conversations that I capture in the book. I highly recommend his wines, too, and anytime you can listen to him talk. I've interviewed him on Facebook Live video previously, and he's terrific. But I agree with you. His Rhone Varietals, the cigar, the cigar. That wine, oh my gosh, it's just to die for. And it's just beautiful, dusty, spicy, full-bodied, somewhere mid-Atlantic signature, I think, between the old world of the Rhone Valley and the new world fruit and power.
Yeah, that's a perfect, yeah, I have one bottle left of the 2010, and so I'm saving that for some point. How different is the... How different would you say it is now versus when you started getting into wine in terms of being a woman, in terms of just getting the access, being treated with the level of respect that would, you know, that you would deserve? It's funny. It's a privilege I have as a guy, where it's not something I've ever had to deal with. And when I look at most of my interviews, it's more women than men. I have, you know, most of the smartest people I know in wine and the most impressive people I know in wine are women. So I think I almost forget the fact that it's harder to be in this industry. I'm curious about what it's like now versus when you got started.
I remember one of the first conversations when I got started was with a veteran wine writer on the phone, and I was asking for advice, and he said, well, don't expect to make a living from it. Treat it as a weekend hobby, sweetheart.
Oh,
so that put fire under my burner, and that was probably more motivation. Sorry?
Oh, no, I just said what a delightful answer that person gave you.
Yes. No, yeah, that probably was more motivational than if he had tried to encourage me.
Right.
And so things are changing. Yes, there are more women in all walks of wine life. But I think there are untold stories, and those are the stories I plan to explore in my next book, of women who do have a tough time in the industry. They're afraid to speak up. Some of these stories are starting to surface in the news, like over the last couple of years. Mm-hmm. And I think there'll be more of them, just like there are in the entertainment industry. Now, that said, I think there are an incredible number of supportive men in the industry, and I've been fortunate to interact and work with a lot of them. But I think there are a lot of stories still that need to be told, and there's a lot of ground that still needs to be covered when it comes to women and wine.
Yeah, you're right. And it's always, to me, and this is just me being naive, it's always such a weird one when, you know, people would look down on a woman in the business when there's no difference between a male or a female when it comes to assessing wine, writing about wine, blind tasting about wine, or anything like that. Like, there's no, it's not like one gender would be better than the other. And I've heard that actually women have a better sense of smell than men. So I feel like that's still persisted.
Yeah, they're 25% of the population are super tasters, and more than half of them are women. I'm one of them. I got tested in California. I got my taste buds. Yeah.
That is what? How did I bury the lead?
No. So I've got a lot of taste buds. Oh, well.
That's awesome. How do you get tested for that? Now we're going a little bit heavy, but I have to ask, how do you get tested for that?
Well, do you know a man named Tim Hannay?
No.
Okay. So you need to look him up and maybe even interview him on the podcast, because he's terrific. He really knows his stuff. He's down in California. And if you, I think his website is myvenotype.com, but he has all of this scientific equipment, and he dyed my taste buds blue and then gave me various taste tuds and taste I'm getting my tongue wrapped around this, taste tests. Yeah. And he can, through the use of his magnifying technology and this dye and everything else, he can take a small sample snapshot of your tongue and look at the density of your taste buds, and also the taste test will tell him as well.
Yeah.
So Jancis Robinson is a super taster, but super taster, I should clarify, doesn't mean you're a better taster. It just means you're a more sensitive taster. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, becoming a better taster is something that happens with practice, but you're talking about innate or biological differences between men and women. The majority of super tasters are women because of that density of taste buds. Who knows why? If that was because traditional roles of cooking or tasting berries first so the kids wouldn't die, I don't know. But that's sort of what it is.
Natalie, as we end this, I'm curious, and I'd love to like chat with you again somewhere down the road. Where would you like to see, because, you know, your website from where it got started to now, your newsletter to how many subscribers you have, it seems to, you know, it's grown and grown over the years. And again, it's NatalieMcLean.com. Where would you like to see it or yourself a couple of years from now?
Oh, more money, less work.
There you go. That's a great answer. That's a fed. You know, it's funny that it. There might be, you can certainly expand on that answer, but in one way, that's kind of all of our goals, isn't it?
Yes, and a cellar full of DRC.
Yeah, that'd be fun. Yeah, I'd be good. That's if good. You need something to come over, I'll bring the crazy straws.
Okay, great deal. We're on.
Yeah, Natalie, really appreciate you joining. Again, people go to NatalieMcLean.com/Matt to check out her food and wine pairing guide. Go to the website, again, NatalieMcLean.com, and look out for her third book. If you haven't read the first two, you should absolutely give them a read. Natalie, thanks so much for joining the podcast.
This has been so much fun. Matt, we'll have to do it again.
Love to. Thanks so much.
Okay, cheers.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.